from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The pages of comic books are most often thought of as places for superheroes and evildoers, but over the course of his career as a cartoonist and screenwriter, Daniel Klaus has turned those familiar square panels into windows on the complex challenges of everyday loneliness, alienation, and despair. Oakland-based Klaus joins us to discuss the retrospective of his work, currently showing at the Oakland Museum of California. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this Forum Hour, we talk with one of the world's most celebrated cartoonists, internationally acclaimed award-winning author of comics, graphic novels, and screenplays, Oakland-based Daniel Klaus. A Penn Achievement Award winner and author of dozens of comics and 14 books, two of which were made into the movies Ghost World and Art School Confidential, Daniel Klaus has had a 25-year career presently on display with 100 of his works, an exhibition at the Oakland Museum from now until August the 12th. He's done a number of covers for The New Yorker. He was serialized in the New York Times magazine and has had work appear in Time, Newsweek, and Gentleman's Quarterly, and an anthology of his work, The Art of Daniel Klaus, Modern Cartoonist, edited by Alvin Buenaventura, was recently published by Abrams Books. He joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
A regular listener of Forum, I should mention, sometimes twice
absolutely.
In one day.
So yes, here, yes. I think cartoonists are your best NPR listeners.
These are our real clientele.
Yeah. We have no actual friends. We're trapped in our studios all day, and so our friends are, you know, Michael Krasny and Terry Gross. And
You're telling me you have no social life? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's
an isolato?
It's hard to sit at a drawing board all day and have a social life at the same time. It's a solitary business.
You know who used to say that all the time was Charles Schulz. He said it was very difficult to have a life. But you would think the same would hold true probably for authors and for many people who do isolated work or work alone, not only cartoonists. Yeah,
I suppose so, although I don't know. Authors seem to be able to get out and about a little more. You know, all the authors I know tend to work 2 or 3 hours at a stretch, and then they can't do their best work after that time. And a cartoonist, you know, you can write comics for 2 or 3 hours, and then you have to sit and cut the paper out and draw the panel borders and do the lettering, and there's all kinds of tasks you can fill your day with. The days really do disappear when you're drawing comics.
In a good way, I hope, although certainly you've become much more public of late with the museum showing. I guess, in fact, did you say it felt like you snuck into that museum? I didn't think you'd be honored with a museum showing here at the Oakland exhibit.
It really did feel like I found, you know, there's a secret door behind the men's room or something, and I walked through and all of a sudden, you know, they handed me a gigantic check or something. It had that feeling of somehow.
You're an old TV buff. It reminded of Michael Anthony, huh?
When you, that's right.
$1 million from
boy, we're embarrassing
we're dating
ourselves
here.
Yes.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about old TV shows because I was discovered that we're both fans of a show called Mannix. For those of you with long memories, remember Mike Connors as Mannix. The curator of the show, Susan Miller, actually said something that struck my interest. She said he's the Alex Katz of dialogue. And then I thought, in reading about your education, and I want to sort of begin there, at Pratt in Brooklyn,
yes,
your art education, they were trying to teach you minimalism and abstract expressionism. And you think of Alex Katz, you think of minimalism.
Yes.
But this is not really your...
I have no idea what she means by that, so please... maybe one of your listeners can explain, but
well, you're not a minimalist, you're not an abstract expressionist. You
no.
found that out fairly soon in Pratt, I guess. Huh?
No. I, you know, when I went to art school, it was 1979, and so most of my professors were either, you know, in sort of conceptual artists, or they were sort of older guys who had been abstract expressionists or, you know, color field painters, things like that. which is about as far from drawing comics as there could possibly be. And I had this naive notion that I would go and there would be people who could teach me, you know, what kind of lettering pen to use to letter your comic strips and, you know, how to ink like the pros and all that kind of stuff. And they just thought what I was doing was a total waste of time. You know, I had professors come to me and say, you know, guys who work in comics, I've never met one who wasn't just crushed after a while, just like the most broken man, you know, and it's because you have to work so hard and you make no money and it's just, it's a terrible field. Just don't do it. And somehow that just made it seem more romantic to me. I thought that's, you know.
But you came out of Pratt without a job, too. I mean,
very much so.
That was kind of a depressing prospect at the time.
I was predating the graduates of today, yeah. I think, yeah.
And went through kind of a rough time. Maybe that's a lot where some of your angst and all that comes from, those early years of trying to make a career for yourself. But boy, what a career you've had. Let's go back and review some of it because even though I think you were in a magazine, and again, we're dating ourselves here, that I remember reading called Cracked, which was a takeoff on Mad Magazine. Fairly early on, it was really 8-Ball that kind of got you on the map.
Yes, yes. The work I did for Cracked was I did a comic called The Ugly Family that was sort of an imitation of the Addams Family. And the reason I originally got work for Cracked is that I had this roommate in college who one day saw a want ad, in the New York Post. And it was something like, you know, office boy at Cracked Magazine. And he thought, well, I'm going to try to get this job. And he was a very persuasive guy, a very gifted talker. And he got that job. And I think within 2 weeks, he became editor-in-chief of Cracked Magazine. It was kind of remarkable. And so so that's how I originally got work for Cracked. But they didn't like my work originally. They said, this Klaus guy, you know, you can't use him. And so my roommate, the editor, said, they don't know what they're talking about. Just come up with a new name and submit the same stuff. And so my dad had wanted to name me Stosh when I was a kid, and my middle name is Gillespie. So I just did Stosh Gillespie without a further thought. And the editor or the publisher looked at it and said, oh, this guy's great. Let's use this guy. And so that's how I got to work for
Your dad, I was reading some moving accounts of your dad was kind of like my dad, you know, silent, strong type, didn't necessarily express what he was experiencing in his interior landscape. And you were waiting for some kind of final words when he was in decline and dying and didn't come. And I think what you said was you were pleased in some ways that they didn't come, those final words, because the mystery remained.
The mystery remains, and it's much truer to who he was to have that, you know, that silence and that, you know, not, it would have cheapened things if he had come up with some, you know, words of closure at the end.
Like our beloved Kathy Goldmark, who just before she died never lost her sense of humor, said Rosebud. That she, your character Wilson is kind of based on your father, isn't it?
Well, Wilson's not, my father was nothing like Wilson.
Spurred on by your father.
Spurred on. When my father was in the hospital with terminal lung cancer, you know, you have those days where you're just sitting there in the hospital watching this man who's sleeping or staring at the ceiling, and to keep myself from, you know, slipping into despair, I bought a little notebook at the hospital gift shop, and I thought, I'm just going to start drawing funny little comics to amuse myself. And I drew these kind of stick figure comics of this character that just emerged without any forethought, you know, this guy who didn't even have a name, who was just basically me saying the things that I would say at my darkest moment if I were much more courageous than I am. And I've found it endlessly amusing and truthful. I had been working on a much more ambitious book at the time, and I came home and I kind of threw that in the garbage and started working on Wilson.
Well, he's a kind of misanthrope, but there's a certain nobility to him, and I guess reflects that side of you. It's a sort of catharsis for you in many ways to create characters like that and let out what you call your maybe darker sides?
Though I don't know that it has any therapeutic value. You know, I always wonder if any authors have that, where they can get something out in their fiction or their, you know, their films. Or
we
whatever.
Had John Irving on recently. We were talking about that, and he said, you know, I keep doing it over and over and over again, so I don't know that it really serves the purpose of something that we would think of as therapy. But you, going back to 8-Ball, that was when you began working with a lot of graphic fiction, Ghost World. In fact, the last two parts of Ghost World were in color, yeah?
No. The entirety of Ghost World was in a kind of a strange blue tone. I wanted the look of the strip to replicate. When I was a teenager, I remember walking home from school at early evening in Chicago and looking in people's windows as they got home from work, and you'd see that kind of black and white TV light that would illuminate the interior of their living rooms, and it had this kind of eerie blueness to it, and I always found that very evocative.
The cathode rays.
The cathode rays, yes. I think that's gone in the age of 50-inch plasma sets.
Well, do you see things visually first, or does the story come to you, or how does that, or is it a different trajectory for different work?
Yeah, I try to work differently with each new book. I try to, I try to go in different directions, and often I kind of wind up at the same spot, but I try to have a different starting point. But often it's a little visual idea or just a little a joke of some kind, something just to get you started. That's all you need is a start, and then the journey is, you know, kind of finding what you're looking for.
Crumb was a big influence. Huh?
Absolutely, sure.
And had you ever imagined, I don't know if Crumb would have imagined, that comics would have attained such a kind of status as art and graphic novels become as influential and important as they've become?
No. If you had told me that back when I was in school, I would have just imagined some precipitous cultural decline. You know, like think of that movie,
Dystopia.
Idiocracy. Yeah.
You've had a number of covers for The New Yorker, very, in fact, engaging covers, to put it mildly. Have you ever had any problems with them? Because I remember when I interviewed Art Spiegelman, he said they censored at least one or two of his covers. You didn't have any problems with that sort of thing?
Yeah, strangely, no. It took me years and years to finally kind of get into the mindset of doing a New Yorker cover, because it's a very specific language. You know, The image on a New Yorker cover has to communicate a certain kind of idea that's very elusive in a way. And I spent years and years coming up with ideas, and they were often too immediately funny. That's a New Yorker cover. You never look at it and just burst out.
It's supposed to be
into
more subtle,
laughter.
Yeah.
It's more about sort of looking at it, grasping the image, and then there's kind of a beat before you kind of piece it all together and figure out what's going on. And that's kind of a tough thing to come up with.
Is that the most challenging thing for you, or is it because your versatility suggests, I mean, you know, you've done screenplays, you've done graphic fiction, covers, you even did something for Coca-Cola once, I think.
many years ago in my misspent youth.
Well, what's most challenging?
I don't know about challenging, but the difficult thing is when you're trying to do something for an art director or for somebody who is envisioning something and not explaining it correctly to you. And so you're trying to sort of come up with something that's somebody else's vision. I try to avoid anything like that, but I've certainly wasted enough of my time trying to make things like that work.
Where did Death Ray come from?
That was actually a story I wrote when I was about 16 years old. I had read all the early Steve Ditko Spider-Mans, which the nerds in your audience will know what I'm talking about. Those were the very first issues of Spider-Man back when he was a skinny bookworm who lived with his aunt and uncle. And
I know Stan Lee's name was Spider-Man.
Stan Lee was he was the writer, but the artist Steve Ditko was the thing that really drew me to it, was the way he drew this superhero who was looked like he weighed about 100 pounds. And I weighed about 100 pounds at the time and lived with my grandmother mostly and was sort of a bookworm. And I really related to this character. And so the Death Ray was kind of my version of that. I would say homage, but it's much more of a imitation.
And David Boring?
David Boring was a... well, there was an artist who drew Superman comics in the 50s named Wayne Boring, and I just thought that was such a wonderful name. And he was kind of a – I loved his artwork, but it was very boring. It was very – it was without any style or any inflection. You know, it was sort of – it looked like the kind of drawings that you would use for you know, like how to explain to somebody how to get out of their seat when the airplane is crashing or something. And I really liked that. And so that name kind of stuck with me, Boring.
Talking with Daniel Clowes, a retrospective of his work, The Art of Daniel Clowes, Modern Cartoonist, is currently showing at the Oakland Museum in California. There's a new book of his work with the same title. And the retrospective at the Oakland Museum will be showing through August the 12th. He's also a screenwriter. In fact, how did you and Terry Zwingoff get linked up together for Ghost World?
I think Terry's, you know, Terry's friends with Robert Crumb, and I think he was looking for somebody to do a, he had done documentaries before that. He did the Crumb documentary, and he did another one called Louie Bluey, and he was looking to make a non-documentary feature. And I think he wanted to work with Crumb, and Crumb was proving to be too difficult. So he went across the bay and looked me up.
And the characters Enid and Rebecca, played by Scarlett Johansson, of course, in the movie, where did they come from your consciousness?
I had, you know, being in art school and high school, I was always a very quiet guy and the kind of person who would... you know, kind of blend into the background, and people tended to forget I was there. And I found I was spending a lot of time with these outspoken young women in art school, and I was sort of shocked to see how similar they really were to me and my male friends, and in many ways much more uncensored than we were. And I thought they were just such fascinating characters, and I didn't see anything like that in any, you know, in fiction or films or TV or anything. And it just felt like somebody had to do it. It wasn't even necessarily the thing I most felt like doing at the time, but it just felt like there was a need for it out there in the world.
It was a breakthrough, really, in some ways, I think. I mean, young adolescent girls and sort of their world and their perspective and quite believable. I remember my daughter was a teenager and was quite taken with the world that was created. In fact, I think we have a cut from Ghost World from the film. Danny, let me set this up a little bit. I think this is the scene where the art teacher is, well... She's very excited about a work in which they're taking a doll and taking the pieces of the doll, the appendages and whatnot, off and throwing them in the toilet. She has, shall we say, a decidedly political point of view about art. Let's hear this.
I think that Philip and Enid can help us to see that there are many different ways we can express ourselves. We can do things like these cartoons that are amusing as a sort of a light entertainment, or we can do work that is more serious in scope and feeling, and that deals with issues, emotional, spiritual, political, of great importance. Who is responsible for this?
I am.
Talk to us about it.
It's my response to the issue of a woman's right to choose. Mm-hmm. It's something I feel super strongly about.
Isn't this a wonderful peace class? This definitely falls into that higher category of art I was speaking of earlier.
Well, there's some definite satire there about
perhaps the approach, a little over the top.
Well, it's a certain approach of pedagogy that said, you know, work should be didactic and follow social. But I think maybe you were mirroring some of your own Pratt Institute experience.
An act of revenge, I suppose.
On all those teachers who tried to compel you to do work that was different than the cartooning that you wanted to do?
To bend wire coat hangers.
that movie was quite a success, actually, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know. When it came out originally, it was a very small film. And it was actually in the theaters when 9/11 hit. And it was sort of starting to build an audience right around that time. And then all of a sudden, the plight of two directionless teenage girls seemed far less important than it had a couple weeks earlier, and kind of disappeared. But it's had a long life on in the secondary market, as they say.
And you did the screenplay, and we're actually
yes.
had a nomination for an Oscar for that. What about Art School Confidential? How were you involved in that?
I wrote that one also.
You did write that also, and the kind of audiences that generated.
What?
Oh, the success of the movie.
It was not as successful as Ghost World. It was, sometimes they come together perfectly and sometimes they don't, and it's a very difficult formula making a film.
Didn't you also do a video for the Ramones?
I did many years ago, yes, 1995.
I Don't Want to Grow Up.
Yes, yes. It was, I believe, their last album.
And you were in, I suppose, a sign of true success. You were in an episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah, that's probably the thing that, will impress my friends and neighbors the most. My son's friends certainly are quite impressed by that.
Your son, Charlie, who has become a character in your work.
Yeah, how could he not?
We're talking to Daniel Klaus, and let me open the phone lines. Cartoonist, screenwriter, and there's an exhibition of his work presently at the Oakland Museum in California. And you can join us if you're a fan of his or if you have something you'd like to ask him. Budding cartoonist, questions, comments are welcome, and the number is toll-free and available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Call us now if you'd like to join the program, and we do welcome your involvement in the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. That's our email address. You can also go to our website and communicate with us that way, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. And again, the toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786. How about living in Oakland? I mean, how's that influence your work?
I love Oakland. Oakland, the quality that Oakland has is that it's a small enough city that it feels almost like a Hollywood set of a city or something. It has, if you go to New York and look around, you might be on a block in the Upper West Side and you'd see 10 beautiful Art Deco buildings all in a row. And it's overwhelming. You just sort of dismiss it and move on to the next thing. But in Oakland, there's, two or three beautiful Art Deco buildings, and you can obsess over them. And I was trying to think why I don't really relate to San Francisco as much as I do to Oakland. And I was trying to think, why is that? And
Visual.
Yeah, I think it is a visual. I mean, I think I'm more of a arts and craftsman person than a Victorian person. And I think those are the sort of the reductive ways I look at those two cities.
Daniel Klaus, our guest, if you'd like to join us, toll-free number available, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners, and you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A couple of Midwest boys here getting together talking about the work of Daniel Klaus. Daniel Klaus with us in studio, Chicago born and raised. And the pages of comic books are often a place, as many of you know, for superheroes and evildoers. But over the course of his career as a cartoonist and screenwriter, he's turned those familiar square panels into windows on the complex challenges of everyday loneliness, alienation, and despair. And his work is currently being shown at the Oakland Museum of California, and we're going to go to your calls and emails here. Just want to ask you, though, just for the record, so many comic lovers and followers of your work, and we mentioned Crumb, talked about Harvey Pekar a little off the air. Who are your main influences, though, besides Crumb?
Well, I like, you know, the guys who did the original Mad Magazine or Mad Comics, I guess, you know, back in the 50s, Harvey Kurtzman and his best artist, Will Elder, and some of the other guys, Wally Wood, and those guys are...
Remember the name Melvin Kosnovsky?
Of course.
But, you know, a lot of people don't remember that was the name for Alfred E. Newman early on in the
Mad Magazine. Yeah, they were just throwing around. I think those were all names, you know, from his childhood. I was very, you know, that in Mad Magazine, they always had the word Potter Zeebe, and I was very crushed to one day learn that that was pronounced Potter Shebia.
I had a kid in my fourth grade class who looked identical. He was a doppelganger for Alfred E. Newman. And you look at the picture,
wow,
and you think it's almost Photoshopped or something with that face. So who else besides Harvey Kurtzman and Will Elder?
You know, I mean...
Eisner?
Yeah, I like Eisner. I never was a huge fan of Eisner. I like all the early, you know, comic strip guys, George Harriman and George McManus of Bringing Up Father and Winsor McCay of Little Nemo and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that stuff was never really topped. Oh. And, you know, along with Crumb, my favorite would be Charles Schulz.
Let's find out what our callers have to say, and we begin with Steve. Good morning. You're on forum, Steve. Welcome.
Good morning. I'd like to bring up Blues Hammer from the Ghost World film. I just want to congratulate you for making something that's really entered the lexicon of at least my peer group. Even people I don't actually know were talking to, not talking about the movie or anything. We're talking about some terrible band. We'll refer to Blues Hammer, and just how perfectly that sums up, Blues Hammer, to the point where I can't really put words to it because it's just so perfect. It's just become the word for it.
Well, I came up with the name Blues Hammer, but the idea for that band is all Terry Zweigoff, and he actually even wrote the song. He's referring to this.
Tell us what this is.
It's a blues band in the film Ghost World that's all made up of, you know, kind of white frat boys who are singing a song about picking cotton in the fields. And
I remember the name. That's funny.
Yeah, and it's funny. You know, a couple of years ago, my wife and son and I were at the Alameda County Fair, and there was a band there called Blues Hammer, and I think without any awareness of the film. So it's entered the zeitgeist.
Or maybe with awareness.
I don't know. They didn't seem to play as though they had any awareness.
Well, thank you, Steve, for the call. And we'll bring in more of your calls. Liz is joining us from Napa. Hi, Liz.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My son recently graduated from the California College of Arts, and his intention was to build his portfolio and join the ranks of struggling artists and trying to break into the commercial world. He's always been drawn to comics and used to draw comic strips as a young kid. So my question to your guest is, how does one really, you know, pursue that, either by finding a mentor or, you know, just striking out his own and sending as much material out, or what's the best way to, you know, to coach a young person trying to go into the art world?
Yeah, how do you break into cartooning? Good question.
You know, it's whenever people ask me that, I get a little worried because it's not like a job. It's not one of those fields that you can, you know, just apply for jobs and get a gig drawing comics. It's the kind of thing that if you can't not do it, you should, you know, that's when you draw comics. But it's a very, very tough way to make a living. And, you know, but if this young man is really, really into drawing comics and that's what he wants to do all the time, I just recommend he either write his own stories or find somebody to write some stories for him and draw some comics and do his best work and send that out. I mean, the beauty of comics is that somebody can hand you their comic and you can look at it, and within 10 seconds you can apprehend whether it's good or not. You know, it enters your brain in such a way that it's almost immediate, you know, and you certainly can't have that with fiction. You can't just look at a page and all of a sudden absorb that the guy can write. But you know, if somebody's really good at comics, they will get some attention.
It's the distinctiveness of the style. I mean, when I think of, like, the political cartoons, like Oliphant and everything, there's a specific kind of distinctive quality to what they do.
But that's also a thing I try to steer away from, is suggesting that anybody try to invent a style, because that's – I think they teach that in schools, and people start drawing in the Disney style or the Pixar style or the whatever style, and I find that so repellent.
I think we're talking about individual style, like when an author finds a voice.
Yeah, but that style has to come naturally. It's very tempting to try to sort of introduce little quirks into your artwork that will make it look distinctive in a way. But I think it has to come organically. And I'm trying to draw without a style. I'm trying to make my images look like the way I see reality in my mind, as you know, when my eyes are closed.
Do you do other kind of drawing, painting, or non-cartoon drawing?
Occasionally, but not painting so much. But occasionally, just to loosen up a little bit.
And your son Charlie showed disposition toward cartooning at all? Or?
No, I think he's figured out that I can do it, and he doesn't need to do it himself.
Let me bring more callers onto the program, and we go to Piedmont. Joe, welcome. You're on.
Yeah, hi. I was wanting to know if Daniel had any notion about doing any sort of animation for television, like turning one of his books or series into a TV show, you know, like Boondocks or, you know, even The Simpsons was Groening's creation, you know, from all the Life and Hell stuff. So just wanted to know.
You know, it's there's something about animation. I feel like I'd have to be in absolute control of it in a way that is perhaps not possible in television. I don't know. You know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want anybody else imitating my artwork. I'd want to have it look absolutely like I did everything, and that can be done, but it would be very, very time-consuming.
Matt Groening was very frustrated early on, I know, because I know him, you know,
sure,
in terms of The Simpsons and all that. Well, you know, it's like, I guess, writing a novel and having it turn into a film script or something. You know, you get toyed with and it becomes something different than what you would
absolutely
set out to do.
So, but I could imagine doing a feature film one day where I had absolute control. And, you know, of course, how do you get absolute control over a feature film? But I'm speaking theoretically.
Use your own money.
Exactly.
Daniel Klaus is here with us in studio, and if you'd like to join us in conversation, you're certainly welcome to do that. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. Has it been a thrill to have your work at the Oakland Museum, and what's that been like for you?
Well, you know, this curator, Susan Miller, approached me many, many years ago about putting together a museum show of some kind, and the one place I really wanted it to be was at the Oakland Museum. I really love that museum. Actually, they sent me an email this morning that said, make sure you say the full name, the Oakland Museum of California. So, but it's I like the of California part is the part I really like. I like walking through that hallway to my exhibit and seeing the, you know, the paintings of the Sierras and the old photographs and the 50s abstract expressionist San Francisco artists and all that stuff, and then sort of finding my way amongst those. And I like being a regionalist.
How did you decide on 100 works? And that must have been difficult, because you're talking about a 25-year career, narrowing it down to 100 selected works.
Well, we were going by what I still had in my flat files, which was one of my main reasons for agreeing to do this show, is I thought I could get somebody to organize my flat files after 25 years, and somehow that didn't really happen. But you know, there's limited space in any room, even though the room we're in is fairly large, and 100's actually quite a few. So, you know, we got all the best things, I think. There's a few things we couldn't turn up that got lost in the early years, but most of it I still had.
Well, there's also some in the anthology that's out now of your work. a lot of photographs of you from your boyhood, and I mean, you went. It looks like you went back to a whole box of photos or something along those lines.
You know, originally when they asked me to do that book, I thought, you know, I'm going to have absolute control over everything in here, and it's, you know, there's all this stuff that I'd be embarrassed if the world were to see. And then at a certain point, I thought the only way this could be a good book is if I just turned off any filter I had and just let the editor, Alvin Buenaventura, go through my stuff and pick whatever he wanted and put it in the book. And I thought that would be the book I'd want to see of another artist. So
our guest this hour is Daniel Klaus, and let me get another caller on, and that's you, Bob. Hi, welcome.
Oh, hi. My daughter's really into manga, and I kind of was wondering what Mr. Klaus's feelings were about that, and how is it different from comics? I'm kind of confused about it myself.
You and me both, yeah.
We did a whole program on manga years ago. It's a phenomenon, though.
I guess it still is. It's, you know, they're much faster paced than American comics. You know, there's two or three panels on a page, and the books are often, you know, 700 pages long, but you can still read it on a subway ride, you know, and I find it interesting, but it's, there's very little of it that I, you know, go back and reread a second time. You know, there's a guy Tezuka, I guess it is, who is sort of the doyen of manga, whose work is really good. And there's another guy named Tatsumi whose work I really like. But most of it I find I just can't, you know, get lost in it the way I'm looking to get lost in a comic.
What about the comic movies that have been made? I mean, in fact, have you seen The Avengers?
I couldn't have less interest. You know, if you had told me when I was 16 years old, there's going to be a movie about the Avengers, I would have said, like, you know, what can I do to fill the time between now and the day that movie opens? Because I can't wait to see that. You know, there's nothing I'd rather see more. And now you really could not force me to see
it. A sign of jaded maturity or something.
I guess. You know? I just, you know, not interested.
Well, I did see it, mainly because so many reviews were so favorable and people said, you know, this is the best comic strip movie that's ever been made and all that sort of thing. It was okay, but, you know, it was like a lot of movies that are made nowadays. There's a lot of crashes and shoot 'em ups and, you know, the usual expected fill of that sort of stuff. And not a great movie by any stretch, by my judgment.
When I was a kid reading superhero comics, I would just flip past all the parts where they're in their superhero costume or where they're fighting and look for the, like, romance part, you know, where Superman's, you know, doing stuff behind Lois Lane's back or things like that. That was much more interesting to me, just like the sort of the domestic side of the superhero.
Well, romance figures in your work, and it's usually in many ways kind of, well, a certain sadness and unrequited nature of romance, rejection and all that.
Huh. I wonder where that could come from.
What is this? We're getting some heat on Twitter for saying in our introduction that pages of comic books are most often thought of as places for superheroes and evildoers. That's admittedly sort of an outdated and somewhat stereotypical view, and in fact, the genre long ago expanded its scope. Maybe you want to address that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, I'm certainly still bitter about having started my career. You know, the only place you could buy comics when I started my career were in specialty shops that sold only superhero comics. And, you know, I'd have girlfriends whose parents would ask me, you know, where can we get your comics? And I'd say, well, you know, you have to take three subways to the far north side of Chicago, and there's a dingy little store with a guy who's, you know, sleeping on a mattress in the back of the store. And you walk in there, and there's a box in the back that says adult, and it'll be in there, you know, amidst all the pornography and whatever else.
I was going to say the porn was there too.
Yeah, and so it's, you know, so I still have this chip on my shoulder about being stuck in that box. But absolutely it's true that comics are about all different kinds of subjects now. And, you know, it used to be you'd go look at if a bookstore had a graphic novel section, it would have Mouse by Art Spiegelman and maybe a few Linda Barry books or something. And then that was about it. And now, you know, they can fill 2, 3, 4 shelves.
I should tell you, a few years ago, I did a did a textbook with a local professor named Maggie Sokolik, and she wanted to include graphic fiction. And so it was a big learning curve for me, but I realized, you know, there's an extraordinary range. So let me redact what we said.
Yes.
About, because you can get Proust, you can get almost anybody you want now in graphic form or in graphic fiction. And the truth of the matter is, some of it's damn good.
Yes.
It reminded me when I was a boy of classic comics. you know, those were really popular. You would get, like, you know, Thomas Hardy in comics. You'd get George Eliot in comics and everything. And those are now become, I think, collector's items, just like the old horror comics, which you may remember.
Yeah.
As well, which were pretty scary. I mean, they were terrifying.
I would never let my son—I have my—I have reprints of all those old horror comics, and they're on the top shelf in my studio, and my son will never be able to read them until he's tall enough to reach them.
They're frightful, aren't they, really?
They're horrific.
Yeah.
They were—
Because
there
was no censoring until people started talking about comic books as being pollution of the mind and subversive and McCarthy-era stuff. And
yeah,
all.
Yeah. I mean, it makes you, you know, you can have a certain amount of sympathy for the people who burned them because they really were that extreme, as much as I love them.
Here's Violet. It says, I have always wanted to do a film of Like a Velvet Glove cast in iron. It feels like a storyboard for film. Can you talk about this book a little? And also, many pieces of I Hate You Deeply and much of your work have become a huge part of my lexicon and that of my friends. Your view of the urban landscape is amazing. Thank you for it.
That's nice. Like a Velvet Glove cast in iron was sort of the first long story I did, and it was based on my, you know, troubled early 20s, but I was trying to write almost automatically and draw the pages as they popped into my head without any real forethought for where the story would go.
And it was like automatic writing, really.
In a way, yeah. I mean, you know, you can't really do that in comics because it takes so long to draw the pictures, but I was trying to keep that as going as much as I could, and it was really kind of a tightrope walk for several years of keeping the story going. But, you know, people are always asking to make a film of that, but it's I can't imagine anybody actually giving a filmmaker money to make it. I think a lot of filmmakers would like to do it. But
speaking of films, here's Steve who writes, my favorite line from the movie Ghost World was from the Steve Buscemi character. He said, I hate my interests. Were those characters' interests yours? Do you hate them? Or were those interests more based on someone else?
Those are all Terry Zwigoff's interests.
Another listener, Steve, says, hi, Mr. Klaus. I am a huge fan since before you were Mr. Klaus. As you mentioned earlier, I read Crack Magazine as a young boy, and my favorite was The Ugly Family.
2 G's, yes.
Are there plans to compile and reprint those strips and want to add the recent one, Two Punch of Wilson and Mr. Wonderful was a triumph? Thank you for all your brilliant work. Steve.
The Ugly Family can't really be reprinted because, do you remember the when there were the anthrax scares and the post 9/11 era, and one of the places that was sent anthrax was the Globe, you know, that which was a tabloid in Florida. The Globe actually had recently bought Cracked magazine, including all its archives, which included all the film, which is, you know, what we have left of our artwork, and actually all my original artwork was in their archive. And so after the anthrax scare, they had to actually burn the entire Cracked archive. So there's no record of it at all. I mean, we'd have to scan it directly from the printed magazines, and it looks horrible in there. So I don't think we'll ever be able to do an Ugly Family book.
That's too bad. I mean, too bad about
it's
all that
tragedy.
Cracked stuff. Some of that Cracked stuff was pretty funny.
That might be going a little far, but...
Well, some of it was pretty funny.
Cracked is actually a very popular website now that has nothing whatsoever to do with, you know, the old Crack.
But the old Crack was kind of a ripoff of Mad Magazine.
It was not only kind of a ripoff, it was the best of the ripoffs of Mad Magazine.
How many more do you remember?
Oh, there were dozens. There were
Can you
Sick
name some
and
of them?
Sick and
Sick.
Crazy and God knows.
You did a poster for a movie called Happiness.
I did do that, yes.
Yeah. How did that come about?
The filmmaker Todd Solondz, I think, was a fan of my work and thought that my style was appropriate for that film, which I don't know what that says about me.
Yeah, he done some strange films. Here's a web comment. I remember reading your story about a traveling caricature artist. I make my living here in the Bay Area working as a digital caricaturist for corporate parties and events, and was wondering where the inspiration for that rather sad character came from and if you have ever worked as a caricaturist.
You know, I did. As a very young kid in fifth or sixth grade, I would take my little drawing pad to the local art fair and draw caricatures. And even then I knew it was sort of a sad endeavor, trying to make people look slightly better than they actually look while under the guise of ribbing them or, you know, sort of making fun of them.
Some of those caricaturists who are at fairs and, you know, will do you, so to speak, for a few bucks are pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, it's a skill. It's like, you know, magic or one of those things where you pick up a lot of tricks. And I actually found a book years ago that was a diary of a caricaturist. And it was sort of he was writing as though he was, you know, sort of helping the budding caricaturist get into the business. But it was this deeply sad record of his, you know, dismal art fairs where he'd drive 600 miles and only get 3 customers. And I thought it was such a poignant, moving book without really intending to be that was the inspiration for that story.
Well, loneliness and isolation do inspire you.
I think so. I think that's another reason I like Oakland, I think.
You gotta have to explain that.
There's a certain loneliness about Oakland. I was actually walking, I was showing a friend around a couple weeks ago, and we were down by Jack London Square, which really should be a big bustling, you know, thoroughfare. And I looked down, you know, there's that street along the Embarcadero there that's where the train tracks run. And I looked in both directions and it just had this kind of Dechirico-esque loneliness about it. There was, you know, you just see shadows of kind of distant wandering figures, and it really seemed like the city was almost abandoned. And I thought that's very evocative.
Some think that the Occupy movement has changed Oakland or has altered what Oakland perhaps was before the Occupy movement. Have any feelings about that?
I don't know. It doesn't. It has. I don't know that it's changed it. That seems like such an Oakland thing, the Occupy movement. You know, Oakland is filled with people who are disgruntled, and that's, you know, it seems like where else would there be something like that?
Well, those who go to the Oakland Museum of California and see
<you.
laughs> and see your exhibit, what would you want them to look for? What would you want them to come away with?
I guess my hope is that people would go in and, you know, just look around and maybe see something that draws their interest and maybe read a page or here or there on the wall, and then they might connect with something in one of those pages or in one of the drawings, and that would lead them to seek out the books. And certainly the books are the final work of art. You know, the stuff hanging on the wall in the museum is, you know, the sort of the process by which that final work of art is created. But I would, that's my main hope, is that it would lead somebody to then take that next step and actually, you know, find themselves getting lost in one of the stories and you know, inhabiting the world of the book.
Which you do in your storytelling, inhabit the stories and get lost in them?
I find that's the only way to do it. You have to kind of put yourself in those panels.
And are there any particular, well, a couple of quick questions. I mean, do you keep all your sketchbooks?
Yeah, I don't throw anything away.
And when you look back at your work retrospectively, what are you most proud of? Or are you most proud of anything?
I'm not really proud of anything, but I used to look at my old work and feel this sense of shame and horror at how it wasn't at all what I thought it was at the time I did it. You know, I do the work and struggle very hard to get a certain look, and then then looking back on it years later, I see all the flaws and the things that I was kind of deluding myself about. And in putting this show and this book together, I've kind of learned to forgive myself and to look at it as a record of myself at that time, and to see that the struggle and the mistakes and the kind of tenseness to the line is part of the record of the work.
It's all part of the growing process.
Yes.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on a kind of a longer book that I'm too embarrassed to talk about.
Well, we'll look forward to it. And
thank
again,
you.
You can actually see a retrospective of Daniel Clowes' work. It's at the Oakland Museum of California. It'll be showing through August the 12th. And his book, or the book that was put together of his work, The Art of Daniel Clowes, Modern Cartoonist, is also out and available. And so good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Appreciate your work, and I'm looking forward to more of it. And I want to announce for listeners that in recent weeks, KQED News and the Bay Citizen have been doing a series of open newsroom events at bars and cafes as a way to connect you, our listeners, to reporters and editors. And in that spirit, we're going to open our phone lines tomorrow at 9 to get your ideas for news stories and forum shows. Nobody knows your community, presumably, and your challenges that your community faces better than you do, or your neighbors. What issues are most important to you? Join us tomorrow on Forum, or post your ideas now on our Open Newsrooms page at kqed.org/community. And thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I want to also let you know that we're going out here with Pickin' Cotton Blues by the band Blueshammer from the movie Ghost World. Forum's senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.